There's a museum in Key West, Florida, in honor of a guy named Mel Fisher, who devoted his entire life to an obsessive hunt for this lost Spanish treasure ship that went down off the Keys in the early 17th century. But before they found the Atocha, which with all its sunken gold and jewels, Fisher's crew stumbled upon what many people consider an even more important treasure, the wreckage of a sunken slave ship called the Henrietta Marie. 7,000 objects cataloged from that site are priceless because they offer some of the most detailed information ever about a truly horrific industry, the transatlantic slave trade that brought some 12.5 million human beings out of Africa. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Just a few of the Henrietta Marie's artifacts are displayed at the Mel Fisher Museum, which is mostly about the jewels he brought to the surface. But the things on display include examples of what were called bilboes, shackles used to confine the Henrietta Marie's miserable passengers by chaining one person to another. Most of those bilboes were of a size that could accommodate the ankles of an adult, but there were tiny ones too, which means children were transported on that ship's many voyages and held in shackles. There are other wrecked slave ships out there containing long-submerged stories about the lives of the people forced onto them. And the search for those ruins is being coordinated by a group of black divers called Diving with a Purpose. When my guest learned about their work, she walked away from her job and her old life to train as a shipwreck diver. Tara Roberts is a National Geographic explorer and storyteller who wrote the cover story for the March issue of the magazine. She's featured in the series Clotilda, Last American Slave Ship on the National Geographic Channel and host of the podcast Into the Depths. Tara, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
So historians think slave ships made something like 36,000 voyages in the era of the transatlantic slave trade, which is a number, honestly, that's hard to even get your head around. Something like 1 in 8 captured Africans did not survive those crossings?
Yeah, I think the number, and this is a number that also astonished me. I didn't know it, but they estimate that 1.8 million Africans lost their lives in the Middle Passage. And that's not a number that I think many people know.
What have archaeologists learned about the conditions on board these ships? What was life like for the people held captive on them?
Well, I mean, I think I'll say it this way. I don't think that it was a pleasant trip. I think a lot of really horrible things happened. But I will say that what we've been doing is trying to tell stories and trying to humanize those folks who were on those ships and tell stories of their lives versus of the horrors and the awful things that happened. I think it's easy to really get stuck in the pain and trauma of that passage. But one of the things that we've been trying to focus on is closure, is healing, is the agency of going out and finding that history and bringing it back into memory. So that's sort of the ways that we've been trying to focus a lot of our storytelling, by finding out the names of the people who were on the ships, really trying to bring them into relief, instead of having them be these sort of faceless, horrible statistics that it's hard, to get your brain around and hard to even want to look at, because it was so horrible.
In some cases, this work has allowed modern day descendants to really learn about, you know, what has happened to people and present their ideas for sort of caring for the souls of their ancestors. Can you talk about the Makua people and the request they had when they learned about this Portuguese ship, I think bound to Brazil, was torn apart by the rocks, and then they had a really beautiful idea for a kind of healing ritual.
Yeah, that's such a great great story, Chris. And I think it illustrates kind of the lens that we're coming into this work with. So in Cape Town, South Africa, they found the ship called the São José Paquete de África, and they found it around 2015. And when the archaeologists, the historians, the divers discovered the ship, they did the test on it to find out really was it the ship that they thought it was, and they confirmed that the ship came from Mozambique, from Mozambique Island actually, and that it was full of an ethnic group called the Makua who live in Mozambique. And when they found out that the ship came from there and they found out what happened, there were approximately 500 people on the ship. Around a little over 200 died that night when it wrecked, and the rest were sold into slavery. But because they knew what happened to all the people on the ship, they decided to go back to the Makua community and to share that news. And the Makua met that news with celebration, which might sound a little bit surprising, but they held a ceremony with music and dance and with speeches. And it for them was a closure. It was a way to know what had happened to people that they hadn't known what had happened to. So in that ceremony, the Makua chief handed the team a sacred vessel that was made out of cowrie shells, and he filled it with soil from Mozambique. And he charged the dive team with going back to South Africa and spreading the soil across the wreck site. And he said to the team to tell the ancestors that they hadn't forgotten about them. And it was their opportunity to touch home for the first time in over 200 years. So it was a symbolic ceremony that they had. But that ceremony really provided, I think, a level of, again, like a level of healing and a level of closure. They ended up having an African American, a Mozambican, and a South African that spread the soil out. And the African American is from Diving with a Purpose. And he can't talk about that moment without tearing up. And I can't really listen to it without tearing up. After it had all happened 3 years ago, I went and I visited the site and I sat at the edge because the site is in a really dangerous, like it's a hard site to dive. So I wasn't able to dive it, but I sat and I could see where the site was. It's sort of marked by a tree and by a boulder because it's in not so deep water. But I could feel what maybe they might have experienced over 200 years ago. Like the water is super cold, it's turbulent. Even from where I was standing on shore, the water was like splashing me and spraying in my face. So I can imagine what it must have been like for them in that hold. But I'll say that I also felt something else because I knew that that ceremony had happened. And I felt just, I didn't like it was a sense of hope and possibility, which maybe sounds like it's a very surprising thing to find when you're looking at a slave shipwreck or the site of a slave shipwreck. But I think that's the power of this work.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, the co-founder of Diving with a Purpose, Albert Jose Jones, feels like this is a reminder to African Americans that their history stretches back so much deeper than the time of slavery. I wonder what changes when you kind of reframe your family's story to focus on the origins of the time when your ancestors lived in freedom?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that much of the storytelling that happens around African Americans, it tends, especially when you're looking at the past, it tends to center inside of our pain and our trauma. But there's so much more to the story. There's so much even more to even those moments in time. Like there are stories of courage, of resilience, of love, of pride. There are all these other things that happen. But I think that the storytelling often stays centered inside of that horror. But one of the, I think, beautiful things about this work around recovering slave shipwrecks and doing work in the ocean is that the ocean is, it's a bridge to that other world. It's a bridge to what came before. So there's a way when we are unearthing or bringing these stories up from the depths, we are providing a pathway to go beyond these shores, these American shores, and go deeper and go further and to find out what came before. So it feels really, it's really surprisingly, it's really exciting and empowering work.
I don't know that I'd had a full appreciation for how hard it is to find a shipwreck, even with modern equipment. Even when search crews have a sense of where something might have wrecked approximately, I mean, it really is like finding a needle in a haystack, right? So can you talk a little about what the process is for even locating these things?
I love one of the archaeologists and divers, Ayanna Fluellen, who's the founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, was laughing when I talked to her. And she's like, Tara, the ocean is so big. But so first, the search doesn't start in the water. It actually starts in the archives. And that's why, even though I focused my storytelling on the divers aren't the only ones that are involved in this work. It's really important for historians and archaeologists to be a part. So it starts in the archives. And it might be surprising for you to learn that most of the ships that sailed across the Atlantic were insured. So when they wrecked, the financial backers, the ship's captains wanted to make their money back, and they would file insurance claims. Huh. And you know how it is now when you file an insurance claim, like the insurance officers come out and they investigate. And so that's exactly what would happen with these wrecks. The insurance companies would investigate. So there's a long paper trail often with these ships, and sometimes they're court documents because some of the proceedings would lead to court cases. So the historians go into the archives, and then there are also captain's records and crewmen records, like people kept logs, and they had a lot of details about the wrecking event. So historians go into the archives and they begin to get a sense of where a wreck might have gone down. So once they get a general sense of the area, then archaeologists come in, and they come in with all the fancy equipment that you mentioned, like sonar scans and magnetometers. And those are used to, they're like used on the surface, and they scan the area looking for anomalies. So metal, things that are not natural to the ocean floor. And when they find those anomalies, then scuba divers come in and start to look with their actual eyes, and they take pictures, and then they try to see what's happening in that area. And then it's not easy still, like even though they're down there, they know kind of the general area. But most of the ships that were built in this period and for this purpose were built out of wood. So they were built in the 1600s and the 1700s. And when they crashed, they splintered into pieces that fell to the ocean floor. And those pieces are often encrusted in coral, or they're turned into homes by marine life, or they're covered by the ocean floor, by the sand on the ocean floor. So they're super, super hard to find. But once they do find some of the telltale signs that it is a slave shipwreck, and you mentioned those in your intro, things like shackles tend to be connected to slave shipwrecks. Things like ballast stones or big piles of bricks might indicate that it's a slave ship. And they would use bricks or ballast stones, like a lot of them, to balance the weight of the human beings in the cargo hold. So there tend to be signs like that that indicate it might be a wreck. But even then, you don't really know. And so archaeologists then have to test the artifacts to see if they match with what the records say. And once the wreck site has been identified, it's like, that is the wreck site. Then the process comes in around actually mapping the shipwreck. And that's the process that I've learned. And that's also super hard to do.
And a
I don't
ton
know
of
if you want to be
math,
able to
right?
do
I mean, like lots and lots of math all the time.
Yes. Because when you're down there, one, you have to draw. So you hover in place. Like you go down with a buddy, and the wreck site is mapped out. So people sort of know generally like how far the site spreads, and how deep it goes. And they put a baseline, which is sort of a long measuring tape from one end of the site to the other. And then you and your buddy are assigned a section of the site, and you go down, and your job is to map the artifacts in that section. So you've got a measuring tape, and you've got to measure the distance from the baseline. You've got to draw the artifact. And once all the teams, and typically it's, it could be like 30 people down there at once, all in teams of two. Once all of your teams have drawn the artifacts and mapped those artifacts, they then take all those drawings and those mappings or those measurements, and they create a rendering. So an architect becomes involved and creates a rendering of the site so that we can actually see it and can imagine what the wrecking event was like.
So that sounds like months and months, if not years, of work to fully document a site.
Oh, it's years. It's years. I was saying that the Guerrero, the ship that started all of this in like 2004, has still not been fully identified. The last I knew, there were about 700 anomalies that they were still trying to check to see if they could indeed be the site. So it takes a lot of time. And the ocean doesn't stay still. So these artifacts can be covered one day and they can not be covered the next day. So maybe you see it on a day when they're not covered, but you go back the next day, they're covered. So it can be hard to find. And the currents sometimes move these artifacts around. So it is definitely not an easy job.
How are decisions made about which artifacts will be brought to the surface?
Ooh, that's another great question. I think there was one moment in time where the thinking was to bring everything up, but that has changed over the years, especially when you think about how these wrecks have become a part of the ocean floor and ocean life. So as I said, sometimes they're encrusted with coral. Sometimes they're home to marine life. And if it's possible to not disturb that, then many teams decide not to do that. So only really key pieces are often removed from the site, and a lot is still left down.
I know that you have your dive buddy when you are down below the surface, and other people may be working in similar pairs, but I can't imagine you can talk too much. I'm really curious about the conversations that happen when everybody is back on the surface and on the boat and maybe heading back to shore.
Well, I don't know if this is a little unusual, but I will say that on boats that have, I think, a lot of Black folks on them, there's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of joy, but they're also, I mean, the work is hard. So a lot of times we come up, we're tired. You want to eat. You want to take a nap. You want to talk about what you've seen. And after the dive, like then we go sit in a room where we're drawing. Like we have to take our drawings and map them onto a different sort of paper. So it's also sort of intent, actual work that is happening. But I think what you're asking is like, how do you process some of what you've seen and you've experienced? And that definitely happens through conversation. Sometimes it's through storytelling. I know once we were all out, and we were on the boat with this awesome storyteller from Costa Rica. She's the person who has created the organization down there that's doing the work to document the two slave ships in their harbor. And she's written this, her name is Maria Suarez Toro. And she's written this story called Tona Ina. And it's about a light in the bottom of the ocean, and that light is guiding divers to the lost souls to help bring their memories or their stories back into collective memory. And so on one mission, Maria told us the story of Tona Ina, and we all, like, we were sitting in the bow of the ship, and she's up on up on a bench, and we're all seated down on the floor of the boat, just looking up at her. And she told us this story for like an hour, telling us all the ups and downs of Tona Ina. And it's a fictional story, but it was so beautiful. So sometimes it's storytelling. Sometimes there are tears, but there also is some laughter and some joy too.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So I'm curious, were you a diver at all before you decided you wanted to do this? Because I know you had to like sort of do your own preparation before you could even be accepted for training in this program.
Not at all.
Wow.
Not even a little bit. Well, I will say maybe 15 years ago, I was on vacation and went to a resort and did like a half a day of diving, but that was 15 years ago and I had not been diving since. I am a lover of water though. I love to swim. I like to be in water, but I never really thought about scuba diving or having scuba diving be like a central part of my world. So no, when I decided to do this, I had to go get scuba trained. And it took me, I was in a 3 month long class. And then to participate in Diving with a Purpose, I had to go get 30 ocean dives under my belt
Wow.
and practice my buoyancy, because the thing about mapping shipwrecks is that you have to stay still so that you can draw, and trying to stay still in the ocean is not easy. So you've got to really like practice your breathing, like in breaths help you rise, out breaths help you descend. So really playing with that and figuring that out takes some time. So I had to go get all of that training in before I could participate in the training.
This work is so physically intense, intellectually intense, emotionally intense. Does it ever find its way into your dreams at night?
Yeah, it does. It's funny, actually, before I set off on kind of the first mission, I had a dream that someone whispered a word in my ear, and it was a word that I wasn't familiar with. And I woke up and I wrote the word down phonetically, and it sounded to me like they were saying Iwe. And I was like, what is Iwe? I didn't know what it was. Fast forward a few months later, I was in Benin and Togo. And this work has taken me all over the world, from Mozambique, South Africa, Senegal, Benin, Togo, Costa Rica, St. Croix, and around the US. But I was in Benin, and I wanted to walk the slave trail there. And I also wanted to visit a barracoon, which is where they would keep captive Africans before they were sold off. And I wanted to stand at the edge of the beach and look back. Those moments, or those ports or points, are called doors of no return. And so I wanted to stand at one. And anyway, I was in Benin, and I met some people there, and they started to tell me about who lived in Benin, what the ethnic groups were. And one of the ethnic groups was spelled E-W-E.
Oh, wow.
And it was pronounced Iwe. And I was like, what just happened?
It's really astonishing that that energy might have somehow found its way to you.
Yeah. I think, like your caller said, you know, it's a very African belief to believe in the ancestors, but it feels like the ancestors, those who were lost, are calling for a time of reckoning. Like they're ready for their stories to be raised from the depths and brought back into memory. So I think they were speaking. They're calling.
Tara Roberts is a National Geographic explorer and storyteller. You can watch Clotilda, Last American Slave Ship, on the National Geographic channel and find Into the Depths wherever you get podcasts. Tara, this has been so interesting. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, it's free where you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.